Well, how I look at it is, I have a friend who's a violin maker who uses a thicknesser, a sander for thicknessing cello ribs. He probably uses a Dremel for the purfling. He has a router copier that roughs out his archings for him. That's fine, that's his business. I mean, you know, he does it like that. To be honest, like, I'm 36 and I'm starting to get arthritis in my fingers, and I my hands are starting to hurt when I'm making stuff now. So I'm actually thinking, actually, maybe if I want to carry on in 10 years or 15 years, maybe I'll have to use some machines because my fingers hurt too much, because I've been working like the apprentice since the start. He's supposed to just be doing the purfling in the end and having everyone else doing all the hard work. You know, before violin makers in the 18th century, or the 17th century, they would have had a bunch of sons for, oh, make that flat for me, you know, like, you do all the planing and all the rubbing and and all that, and I'll just do the little fine work, you know. So there's a bit of that, but at the same time, for example, I've got a big bandsaw, and I've got a table planer that I bought a couple of years ago. The first 15 years I didn't have them, and So I bought them after I'd finished my house. I'd just planed all the beams and all the rafters and everything in the house by hand, and I was knackered. and then I wanted to make some flute cases and things like that. And it's just impossible. Like, by hand, if you've got a plank that's 2 centimetres thick and you want a piece of wood that's 5 millimetres thick, by hand, sawing stuff like that, you know, if it's 6 inches thick, you literally have to saw it in two and then plane it down to the thickness you want, because you can't cut straight enough. It's just not possible. So, by hand. So you're actually using machines for that kind of thing. You save loads of time, loads of effort that you can concentrate on something else afterwards. And you save a lot of material as well. You don't need, with a bandsaw, you don't need as, you know, a bandsaw cuts straighter than I can cut with a massive saw with big teeth through a really big piece of wood. It's really hard to cut really straight, you know? So using routers and that kind of thing is, I draw the line. I like using the, you know, the bandsaw in the same way the sawmill uses a bandsaw to chop the tree up. I'll chop it down to a size that I can make a violin out of, and then I'll stop and I'll do it by hand. But I'm a tool collector. You know, I collect tools, like all sorts of tools. And what I see when I look at old instruments, when you look at a Strad, you get something that's fairly symmetrical and really quite clean and proper and really well made. You know, it's a really beautiful thing. But when you look at something like a Del Gesu or, you know, Guarneri's or more lumpy makers, like, you know, the scrolls that can be covered in gouge marks, probably when they were made, the gouge marks, you couldn't see them as much because the varnish sort of levels. It's like, you know, like old gloss varnish, old gloss paint. It sort of levels, the brush strokes go away. And it kind of levels out over the tool marks and they disappear. And then the minute the varnish starts to wear, the tool marks stand out because they keep the colour and the rest goes away. So then you start, the instrument starts to get a patina, and then you start to actually see how it's made, you know. So, or if something's completely asymmetrical, I mean, carving a violin scroll, basically one side you do it with your right hand and the other side you do half with your right hand and half with your left hand, because it's turning in the opposite direction. Mm. So if you want the same movement, you've got to use the same gesture. Mm. So you've got to do it with the other hand. So I can't carve scrolls sort of, probably 3/4 right-handed, and then some bits I'll do left-handed. Mm. You know.
But when you carve a scroll,
yeah,
couldn't you just go maybe clockwise one way and anti-clockwise?
No, you have to carve downhill. Yeah, no, because you'd be carving against the grain. Uh-huh. And the flame maple is the nastiest wood in the world to carve already. You don't want to go against the grain as well. So anyway, so when you start looking at woodwork as like classical woodwork as, in fact, these people, they've never seen anything made of melamine or hardboard. They've never seen a perfectly flat kitchen table. Everything made out of wood for them, it was planed or scraped, and it had, like, there are tool marks that you just can't get rid of. On some pieces of wood are just so badly figured that you get a little bit of tear in the, you know, and that's just part of it. And then they had a varnish process that'd fill that tear up, and then when it wears off, we can see it because the varnish is still left in it, you know. When you use, I really hate, like, in Brittany, there's loads of houses that have got wooden beams, you know, they're all the same wooden beams every 2 foot along the house. And I really hate the ones from about 1920 onwards, because they're always pine or oak beams, and they're always planed on a table planer. and they've always got this little ripple on them from the blades of the table planer, and there's nothing. That's why I planed all the beams of my house by hand. So they're all covered in plane marks because it ripped out all over the place, because there's no way you can sharpen your plane every, you know, every five cuts for the scale of a house. So there's lots of rip out around the knots and stuff like that. But I'd much rather see the wood ripped than to see this bubbly effect. And the bubbly, the ripple that you get from the plane, you could sand it off, you know, but then you wouldn't have the plane surface. You'd have a sand surface, and the sanding's not the same either. So I think if you appreciate calligraphy and you appreciate a line that's got energy in it, then symmetry is less important. And then when you start looking at the way, you know, basically not all, but practically all, I don't know, or I can't speak for everyone, but I know one violin maker who uses an outside mould. Well, he's dead now, but Wilfred Saunders in Nottingham, like one of the guys who started the violin school I went to, he used an outside mould. I know, because I saw his mould. But I think most violin makers use an inside mould, and an inside mould is the easiest way to get good joints on your rib structure, but it's the most difficult way to get a perfectly symmetrical rib structure. So you end up with an instrument where basically you make the rib structure's not perfect, you kind of fudge it a little bit to even it up, and then when you make the front and the back, you modify the shape of the corners to even that up, and in the end you can't really see that it wasn't symmetrical, you know, perfectly symmetrical. You can't really see it, it's been balanced, and that's part of the art of making the corners on the violin. And that's how the old ones were made, and that's why they're asymmetrical, you know. So when we make a copy of a Stradivari, I mean, basically, I mean, front or back, left or right, take your pick, it's like four lines, you know. So basically what most people would do, what I do, is I'll pick the back because the back wears less than the front. You can see the corners is harder wood, so it wears less, and generally you'll pick the best side and then double it. Or the last violins I made, like this one, that's a copy of the Gibson Huberman, and it's actually asymmetrical. It's completely asymmetrical. You can see it. I didn't make any effort to balance it up. I actually copied the asymmetry. You know, you can see this shoulder's higher than this shoulder.
Not to me, it isn't. In fact, if anything, I say that was higher than that.
No, it's not. Well, yeah, no, that one slopes down. Mm, yeah, it's completely asymmetrical.